Please be seated. This morning we have State versus Thomas J. Mitchell Hoyle, 20 AP 1876 CR. Could I please start with your appearances? All right, good morning. I have the lineup being 25 minutes, followed by 30, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. With that, let's proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. We're here to ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision granting Thomas J. Mitchell Hoyle a new trial. The Court of Appeals held that certain closing comments from the prosecutor violated Hoyle's Fifth Amendment rights, but when doing so, the court did not correctly apply the relevant legal standard, it misinterpreted this court's precedent, and it failed to read the prosecutor's comments in proper context. We ask this court to hold that courts must engage in a case-by-case analysis and review a prosecutor's comments in context when considering whether they amount to a Fifth Amendment violation. We ask this court to further hold that the prosecutor's reference to the state's uncontroverted evidence in this case was permissible.
Aren't your first two requested holdings merely pablum? To hold that review evidence in context? Do you think anyone on this court would be against that? Or that we analyze it on a case-by-case basis? So, back on that.
Sure. The reason we are making that request is because, so in the Doss decision, the court did observe that that's generally how that analysis has been conducted. We read that as an observation, and the reason that we're asking for a direct discussion of that in this case is because the Court of Appeals decision essentially amounted to a per se rule that a prosecutor's comments about uncontroverted evidence constituted a Fifth Amendment violation when there was only a direct witness to the crime being the purported victim and the defendant. So what we want to avoid here are it is important to hold that this analysis is necessarily contextual and case by case.
With regard to a per se rule, I look to paragraph 19 of the Court of Appeals opinion as they were examining the second factor. And the defense asks us to clarify this. When the Court of Appeals says this factor is met here because the prosecutor specifically argued the lack of evidence. Are you following me, or do you know what I'm speaking about?
Are you asking about the second James factor and whether this court should be adapting that as part of the test? Is that the inquiry?
My inquiry is this. In footnote 11, on page 38 of the defense brief, it asks us to clarify this part of the Court of Appeals opinion, asserting that it doesn't have to be specific. That's what I'm referring to. And if you're not following my question, that's okay. You know, I mean, life is short.
I think that this might help address the question, and please let me know if it doesn't. But as we said in our brief, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals has set forth in the James case a three-factor test to decide whether the prosecutor's comment violates a defendant's rights under the amendment.
I'm going to just interrupt because I said footnote 11. It isn't. It's at the bottom of the text of page 38, not the footnote at the bottom.
Okay.
And they seem to be saying, hey, court, Well, this is what they say. This court may clarify that Jaime should not be read as stating that a prosecutor's argument is only improper if he or she explicitly states that the defendant should be found guilty. And I was just, when you talked about a bright line rule, that word came to mind, this explicitly. Is explicitly a bright line rule? Or should the court, in its wisdom, if it deems appropriate, take a look at the Court of Appeals' use of the word explicitly and water it down a bit?
Perhaps, Your Honor, and that's because the comments, the first question is whether the comments were a reference to the defendant's failure to testify at all. Sometimes that is an easy question to answer if it's a very direct comment. Here we don't have that. We have what at most would be an indirect comment, and what the Johnson court has said, when you look at that, what you need to analyze is whether the prosecutor's comments about the state's uncontroverted evidence, whether the language used was manifestly intended or was of such character that the jury would naturally and necessarily take it to be a comment on the failure of the accused to testify. After you conduct that analysis, then the question is whether this comment on the failure to testify proposes that the failure to testify demonstrates guilt. And that's consistent with Griffin and with Robinson, the U.S. Supreme Court precedent. There, so what we are focusing on, what we believe this case turns on, is whether there was a comment on the failure of the defendant to testify in the first place, basically that first factor. And we'd like to make two observations with respect to the manifest intended, naturally, necessarily standard. First, and most importantly, it is not easy to establish that an indirect comment is an improper comment on the defendant's decision to testify. And we know that just by the language of the test. The defense has to show that it was the prosecutor's manifest intent to comment on the defendant's silence, or the defense has to show that the character of the remark was such that the jury would naturally and necessarily construe it as a comment on the defendant's silence. So the question is not whether the jury possibly or even probably would review the challenged remark in that manner, but rather whether the jury necessarily would have done so.
What was the first word before necessarily?
Naturally. Naturally and necessarily. So a second observation, which I've already touched on a little bit, is that, and this comes from the case law, is that the comments must be evaluated in the context of the entire statement. And so this analysis is conducted necessarily on a case-by-case basis. So the question...
Do we look at the statements just of the prosecutor, or do we look at the statements also of defense counsel?
I think it depends on the case, Your Honor. Sometimes the prosecutor's opening remarks taken together with what the defense counsel responds to and then what is stated on rebuttal all should be read together. Sometimes the focus might be on the opening statement. I think it is, again, context specific. Here, I would submit that all three phases were relevant to the contextual analysis.
Is it just the contents of what the words are, or is it the context of what is going on in the case?
I think that it also could be either one of those, depending on the circumstances. So, for example, I don't think that it's really been put at issue that there was a manifest intent on the part of the prosecutor here. But if we were to analyze manifest intent, we could look at the context of the entire trial record, and you could look at what the discussion was surrounding the motion in limine and whether or not the prosecutor was intending to comment on the defendant's silence. But since we're in the realm of what the jury naturally and necessarily would have concluded, I think the jury trial transcripts as well as the closing remarks could all be relevant to that. But The question, again, for this court is whether the prosecutor's remarks that the state's evidence was uncontroverted would cause the jury to naturally and necessarily take those remarks to be a comment on the failure of the accused to testify. And viewed in proper context, the answer is no. And I'll illustrate that for the court by just focusing on the closing remarks. In his closing remarks, the prosecutor explained to the jury that pursuant to the instructions that it was read, it was to consider solely the evidence offered at trial. And the evidence that was offered at trial was basically Hannah's testimony of the event. The prosecutor explained that her account of the assault was uncontroverted, or in other words, that the jury heard no evidence disputing her account of that sexual assault. Now, the prosecutor went on to say on record number 92, page 21, I think this is key. The prosecutor goes on to say that because you only heard from Hannah about it, you didn't hear from any of her friends or anyone else testifying about it, it all comes down to her credibility. And so then for the next six pages of transcript, the prosecutor proceeded to explain why all the indicia of credibility were met in the case with respect to her testimony.
I think 21 is actually the main issue here, that those lines here, I mean, I think the repetitive nature played into the Court of Appeals decision, but you can absolutely comment on someone's credibility in all kinds of ways without saying that they were the only person to testify they were the only person to testify at the preliminary hearing, at the trial. No one else testified. There are ways to do that without calling into question who testified, which clearly the only other person available to testify about what happened on that day would have been the defendant, because there was only the two of them there, right? I mean, don't we have to take into account the kind of case it is? This isn't a case where there's DNA. There isn't a case where this could possibly be anything else other than his testimony.
Your Honor, I hear your points, but I think we do need to go back to what the test is. And the test is, would the jury have naturally and necessarily understood the prosecutor's comments to be a comment on the defendant's decision not to take the stand and therefore draw an inference of guilt? But in this context, a juror would have understood the prosecutor's comments to mean simply this, that in evidence there was one version of the story, and because only the victim testified about the event, it came down to her credibility. If the jury believed her, the jury should find the defendant guilty. And then the prosecutor went on to explain why the jury should believe her through the various factors of credibility, such as her conduct, appearance, and demeanor while she testified, the clearness of her recollection, all of these other things that were not focused on the nature of the state's evidence. So again, there are situations where a prosecutor's comments could draw some concern, but what we're talking about here is a constitutional violation. Did the comments rise to the level of a constitutional violation? Whether the court, you know, is debating the wisdom of the comments, I mean, that's really not the standard. The standard is what would the jury naturally and necessarily would have concluded.
Do you agree that it does not have to be an explicit statement about his failure to take the stand?
Yes, because what we're talking about here is, at most, an indirect comment.
There could be indirect comments that would rise to that level. This, in your opinion, this just isn't one of those.
That is correct, yes. So, again, because we don't even pass the first question, which is whether the language was manifestly intended to be a comment on the defendant's failure to testify, or one that the jury would naturally and necessarily construe as a comment on the defendant's failure to testify, we don't have a Fifth Amendment violation. But we also then don't get to that second question of whether the comment was an invitation for the jury to draw an inference of the defendant's guilt because the defendant didn't take the stand.
Counsel, most of the law or cases in this area, it's a little bit of a mess nationally and everything, but the Court of Appeals has commented on these things more than we have, obviously some of the tests you're citing here. So my question to you is, do you want us to you know, modify, clarify, or a comment upon in any way, any of the prior analyses or tests that have been, you know, laid out in Wisconsin cases?
Your Honor, I think that at a minimum, it would be appropriate to adopt the standard that analyzes whether a comment amounts to a comment on the defendant's failure to testify. And that would be the one that derived from the Johnson case, which adapted some federal circuit court law about whether there was a manifest intent. I've recited that standard a fair amount today. But that would be, at a minimum, I think that we stated in our opening brief that the James three-factor test is grounded in the United States Supreme Court precedent. Basically, the question is whether do we have a comment in the first place? If we do, did the comment invite an inference on the part of the jury that the failure to testify demonstrates guilt? And okay, let's say we do. Then was the comment a fair response to something made by the defense? I think that that's all consistent with Griffin and Robinson. So I don't know if that needs clarification, but as we said, we think that that's consistent. The key, though, is that to make clear for lower courts that the analysis should be done case by case. I mean, it could be part of the contextual analysis as to, you know, how many witnesses were there, things like that. But that is not a per se conclusion in and of itself.
So is it fair to say, then, that you're obviously asking us to sort of explicitly affirm this Johnson test, but you're not asking us to, which I know derives from federal cases, but you're not asking us to alter in any way or disavow anything from any prior, say, Court of Appeals cases or other Wisconsin cases? Is
that fair? Not from Johnson or James, no. So as we explained, the comments in this case did not amount to a Fifth Amendment violation. The Court of Appeals reached the opposite conclusion in this case, but its decision rests on at least two fundamental errors. First, the court did not correctly apply the relevant legal standard. The court stated that the court did invoke the manifest intent standard, but it said that the prosecutor's comments led the jury to infer that Mr. Hoyle's silence was evidence of his guilt because, and I'm quoting from paragraph 17 of the decision, given the nature of the alleged victim's allegation and the dearth of other facts presented at trial, the only person who could controvert Hannah's testimony was Hoyle. So in that paragraph, the court appeared to assume that the jury would automatically infer from the prosecutor's comments about uncontroverted evidence that Mr. Hoyle's silence was evidence of his guilt. But as we, you know, just explained, and as we discussed in our briefs, a fundamental issue with this analysis is that the court did not analyze the comments in the context of the prosecutor's entire statement to determine what inferences the jury would draw. And as a side note, we would also say that we disagree that only Hoyle's testimony could have controverted the state's evidence. But really what the focus should be is what was the context of the statements to help shed light onto what inferences the jury would draw.
What do you think, since you opened that door, what would have controverted her testimony other than Hoyle's statements?
So in this case, we had the testimony of Hannah. We had the testimony of the investigator. The record does not reveal that any other direct witnesses were there. What we have then at most is that she was cross-examination, which is evidence. I mean, that is defined in jury instructions. And also that she may have told... And again, we're talking about this specific case, right? And so, you know, as we said in our brief, that she could have told a friend. But the context of this trial really was we had the victim statement, and the defense elected not to put on evidence of its own. The defendant elected not to testify. In closing, The prosecutor said, this is the story we have in evidence. It's not controverted. It all comes down to the victim's credibility and whether you believe her.
So when you say she could have told a friend, is there any evidence she told a friend and the friend wasn't called here?
So,
I mean, I want to hear you just answer to Justice Grofsky's question is basically there isn't anything else. There's just her testimony.
So let's, even if we were to assume that that was true, though.
But first the question is, was it true? Is there anything in this record of this trial that said that she told a friend? Case we have here.
Yeah, this is a case that we have here.
So nothing. So there's no other witness that could have been called. So that's what I hear you saying. There's nobody else. There's her and him. Didn't tell a friend. No DNA. You got the investigator who, yeah, he testified. So he's not the person who didn't testify. So who are they supposed to think didn't testify when they keep saying, you only heard from her, you didn't hear from anybody else? What, they're like making people up, and somehow that takes away from them talking about the defendant?
So in response to the prosecutor's closing comments, the defense talked about this. The defense talked about how there was little else out there other than the victim's testimony, which, by the way, was provided to several others prior to trial. But there was little else out there. And I just want to make clear, this court in Bees said that it is perfectly appropriate for the state to say that no evidence has been introduced to show the defendant's innocence. Like, that is Bees. And we want to make sure that the court reaffirms that point. So focusing on whether or not there was something else that could contradict or controvert the state's evidence, again, that's shifting a little bit away from what the focus should be, which is, in context, what would a jury naturally and necessarily have understood the comments to mean? Now,
but there was a lot to controvert her testimony, right? Because the defense's whole closing argument talked about all the ways that her testimony could be controverted, right? In the closing argument, the attorney talks about the investigator and how the investigation was lacking. That could controvert her testimony, right? The attorney in closing talked about there was a mention from a friend from school, but we didn't know who the friend was. That could controvert her testimony, right? If you're talking about credibility, there was no canvas of the neighborhood. There were no other witnesses. I'm just going through. There was no medical evaluation or physical evaluation. So I think that there was lots in the record that could controvert her testimony other than Hoyle's testimony.
So in that case, that what that would mean is that that also detracts from the fact that the jury would have drawn that conclusion.
Well, that's why I asked you the question in the beginning. That was my first question to you when you were talking about
Yes.
And I realize this is in the closing argument, but I was trying to understand what you were saying about context. And if you were just talking about context that the prosecutor was using in the closing, or whether you were talking about context as far as the whole trial from start to finish, because that's how I read, as it buys, I hope. That's what I read from that case, is that you're supposed to look at all of the evidence in that case.
Yes, and I think that's fair. And again, it all comes back to what the specific facts of the case were, and what a jury would have understood the comments to mean. And the state, in this case, what the defense's strategy was to say, well, there are all of these avenues that the state didn't explore. But the state then came back and said, well, what we have in the record is all you can consider per standard jury instructions. This is the testimony, and I am going to carefully explain to the jury why the jury should find this testimony credible. And so, in that context, we have to kind of come back to whether there was a Fifth Amendment violation with respect to the prosecutor's comments. In that, you know, reading, zooming out, and perhaps considering everything that happened at trial. And the state's position is that this is absolutely not a Fifth Amendment violation. There were some federal cases that were cited in Mr. Hoyle's response brief, and I would just comment on those briefly. The weight of them, they nearly universally talked about how this analysis is contextual. But then in addition, the couple that did find there to be a violation when there was a discussion of uncontradicted evidence or uncontroverted evidence, again, it was highly fact-specific and zeroed in on the comments themselves. There was not a conclusion that, well, because there are only two direct witnesses to the crime, any comment on uncontroverted evidence is a per se violation. So it's important to make that clear. The focus is on what the comments were. I think in the Cottenham decision, which I see that my light is on. I can continue with Cottenham.
Finish your sentence.
Okay. In the Cottenham decision, the comments that were concerning to the district court were that the jury should find the witness's testimony credible because it was uncontroverted, and there was also indirect comments about, well, the defendant doesn't have to take the stand. Don't misunderstand the state's position. So those comments essentially combined together caused the jury concern, and that's very different from what we have here. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to address first this idea that we're arguing that context isn't important. Of course, context is important. I don't think we ever argued otherwise. It's just that when we're talking about this, the context of the prosecutor arguing that the evidence is uncontroverted or undisputed, and the only person who can controvert or dispute the testimony is the defendant, then the jury would naturally and necessarily consider that to be a comment about the...
Why can't someone that the victim spoke to about this, either the school officer or the person, the investigator that it was referred to, why couldn't those people controvert her testimony?
Well, let's talk about the specific way that the prosecutor used the word controvert, because there are different ways.
I think also defense counsel pointed out a lot of ways, basically pointing up that there wasn't any evidence presented.
Right. So the defendant did controvert. I mean, the defendant, pled not guilty. He controverted the case, and the defense attorney pointed out how the state didn't meet its burden in various ways.
Well, the defendant did controvert. The whole case turns on whether the jury believed her.
Right.
Right.
But this is how the prosecutor wasn't referring to the defendant's burden argument. The prosecutor, this is what he said. Hannah's testimony that she gave here yesterday is uncontroverted. You have heard no evidence disputing her account of that sexual assault.
How else is he supposed to talk about her credibility? Right? And that's the only issue in the case, right? You've got one victim, sexual assault victim, right? The allegations are he isolated her, he got her down a road, there are no witnesses, right? This isn't uncommon in sexual assault case. That's what sexual assault perpetrators do. They isolate their victims. So she is isolated. There are no other witnesses. Not a surprise. He still has to explain credibility, right? The DA does. Got to go through that credibility instruction. I don't understand what else is to do. She's the only person who testified, and the defense is trying to poke all these holes in the state's case. Every single hole they're trying to poke in the state's case has to do with her credibility, because that is the only issue in the case. So he's talking about the credibility instruction, and he's saying she's the only one who testified. And there's nothing in this case that they can prove to you that's showing that she is not telling you the truth.
Well, certainly the prosecutor couldn't argue. You must convict the defendant because he did not dispute her account of the sexual assault. Right? He can't directly say.
He can't directly say it.
But instead of using the active voice, he used the passive voice. He said, her testimony is uncontroverted. Okay? So instead of just saying, you should convict the defendant because he did not controvert her testimony, he just switched it to the passive voice, says, is uncontroverted. Well, who else could controvert it but Mr. Hoyle? So it wasn't necessarily a reference to him.
But that's the point I was trying to make, that there's a lot controverted. He talked about everything there was to controvert it, right. That the investigation wasn't sound, that there was no physical evidence, that there was no medical evidence, that no one canvassed the neighborhood, that her friend didn't testify, that they didn't have enough evidence from the car. There was lots. And all of that was out there for the jury. So what I don't understand is what you are saying is that because he is talking about her credibility, that comment about her credibility and he is trying to support her credibility means that he is commenting on your client's right to be silenced when there was all the other evidence that the defense attorney pointed out that controverted what she was saying.
Right. But his argument was that it was uncontroverted. So he wasn't referring to the ways that the defendant did controvert it. Right? He's arguing that it was uncontroverted, so he's arguing about how he didn't controvert it by testifying.
Well, no, he's saying it's uncontroverted, right? And you're saying that the only way to have controverted that was that he is saying that would have been your client testifying. And I'm saying that's not right. That's not what this whole case was about. That's not even what his attorney was arguing.
His argument was specifically about her account of the sexual assault.
Which had to be.
Right. So the only one who could controvert it through testimony was Mr. Hoyle.
Is that a key part of your argument, is the fact that when he's arguing, he's saying uncontroverted testimony, and specifically on page 21, you didn't hear from any of her friends or anyone else testifying about it? Is that a key part about here, that we're not just talking about uncontroverted evidence, that there's repeated references to her account,
right,
to testimony, not to whether or not there was DNA evidence, not to any of that stuff, but testimony?
Right. It was about what the jury heard. And he tied it to the jury instructions that say that the jury cannot speculate.
But we're supposed to look at this in context, and if we're looking at it in context, and looking at page 20 of the transcript, just above where Justice Daly just pointed you, and it says, there is absolutely no evidence disputing her account of what occurred. And then the DA talks about, I can pretty much guarantee what the defense is going to do as soon as I sit down. They're going to talk about the investigation. Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? The judge instructed you that you need to read the jury instruction. You're not to base your decision on guesswork or speculation. He's got it all tied into that. That was the lead-in to this. You're not supposed to search for doubt, which they're not. You're supposed to search for the truth, which they are.
Right, but the lead-in to this was also the jury instructions about not speculating. And he was suggesting that instruction not to speculate means that they can't speculate about anything, that they can't come to the conclusion about anything other than what she testified to, other than what they heard. It was almost like a default judgment kind of argument, because they only heard this one story, and he didn't contest it, didn't controvert it. The jury could not speculate into any other version of events other than what she testified to. And that's not what that jury instruction is for. It's for when, you know, a defendant cannot, in closing argument, make up a motive to lie.
That jury instruction is the reasonable doubt jury instruction.
Right.
Yes. That's what it's about. Then jury instruction is about reasonable doubt, right? It's 140, I think?
Yes.
Yes.
Right, but that specific language that he was referring to about not speculating. It's not speculating to say that for the jury to conclude, I don't think the state has proved its case is not speculating. What the prosecutor can argue about credibility, okay, is talk about the consistency of statements, talk about the plausibility of the accuser's testimony. And you talk about just, and part of that plausibility is that, you know, they can talk about how, you know, it is hard for witnesses to come up and make these accusations unless they're true. I mean, that's all within the prosecutor's arsenal, and that's all permissible. What was impermissible was making this argument based on, saying that it was, undisputed, saying it was uncontroverted, saying that the jury heard no evidence disputing her account of that sexual assault, when only Mr. Hoyle could have given evidence disputing her account of the sexual assault. Now, yes, maybe hypothetically, she could have told a different version to someone else, but that's, we all know that happens in some cases, but that wasn't brought up, that wasn't evidence in this case. And in any event, I think a prosecutor would argue that that's consistent. That's different than being uncontroverted. There's a difference there.
Counsel, question for you, I'd asked your opposing counsel as well, but are there any, in terms of the proper framework, counsel was saying we don't need to, not asking us to modify or change anything in particular. She said, you know, go ahead and please affirm this statement from Johnson, deriving from Morrison and these other cases, the manifestly intended, which you've obviously referenced here as well. Is there anything in relation to, again, predominantly the Court of Appeals cases that have handled these sorts of issues that you would like us to say anything different about? Are you comfortable with these cases as they've been handed down, or just making your arguments on that basis?
Well, I think it would be helpful for this court to explicitly adopt that the Morrison test, the manifestly intended, or the naturally and necessarily that language. I don't know if this court has ever explicitly adopted, other than acknowledging it in Doss, with the proviso that if the comments were a fair response to a claim made by the defendant or his counsel, even if they are a comment on the defendant's decision not to testify, that's okay, and that's what the Robinson case said. I would say, like I said in my brief, I think that the way the Jaimes case reformulated the three-factor test, I think some of its it could be interpreted as requiring an explicit reference to the defendant's failure to testify, or explicit argument that you have to find the defendant guilty because of this. I don't think that's necessary. Closing arguments are all about why the jury should find the defendant guilty. So it's the rule. I have it on page 27 of my brief. Basically, is what I think the court should adopt.
So I want to drill down a little bit on the credibility issue, because I'm looking at jury instruction 300, right, which is the credibility jury instruction. And it tells the jury that in determining the credibility of each witness and the weight you give to the testimony of each witness, consider these factors. And the first factor is whether the witness has an interest or a lack of interest in the result of this trial. And then I am looking at page 22 of the closing, and the DA says, you have heard, it's the bottom of page 22, you have heard zero testimony that somehow she, he's talking about the victim, benefits from falsely accusing the defendant of doing this. There is no evidence that she would benefit from it other than him being held accountable for violating her in that way in February of 2017 on that dead-end road. All she wants is justice in this matter. Okay? So that's part of how he's talking about how the evidence was uncontroverted. That's one thing, one part of the evidence that is uncontroverted, that there is zero testimony that she would have benefited from falsely accusing the defendant in some way. I do not see how this comment, how you can draw a line between the dot of this comment and the dot over here, saying that what he is talking about here is Mr. Hoyle's right to remain silent.
There's no question that a prosecutor can refer to a lack of evidence regarding specific factual theories that might be raised by the defendant, and can point out and talk about the credibility. But again, the prosecutor's argument was specifically about her account of the sexual assault. Okay?
And so there are. But it had, this is why I'm getting so frustrated. It has to be. In every sexual assault, almost, it has to be. Sexual assaults are not committed on street corners. They are committed in dead ends in the middle of the night where there are no other witnesses.
Right. So, but, you know, that is true. And I two responses to that. One is more legalistic, one's a little bit more pragmatic. So the legalistic one is that, yes, it is difficult to convict defendants based on accusations that are not corroborated in any way. And that's because our Constitution puts a high burden on the government to prove guilt. They have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and the state, the government, cannot use the defendant's silence to prove their case. They can't call the, they can't subpoena the defendant, and then they can't, if he exercises the right, they can't use the fact that he was silent against him. That is a challenge for the state, and there's many cases besides sexual assaults where there's the crime is isolated, not in public. Lots of these cases are drug cases, actually, where there's a conversation, only two people are part of the conversation, and where the prosecutor erred was by saying that it was undisputed what happened in that conversation when the defendant could controvert. But the practical consideration, though, is that when everyone knows that it is difficult and that the state can't rely on the fact that the defendant won't testify and that they need to get corroborating evidence, it's a great incentive to find corroborating evidence. And in most cases, the government will try and find that corroborating evidence. What makes this case unusual is that, as the defense attorney pointed out, the investigation really was lacking in this case. There were witnesses who could have corroborated the timeline, for instance, the fact that she said to, she had testified that her mother was upset because she was out past when she was supposed to be. There was no testimony from the mother saying, yes, there was this time in February, I remember that night. There wasn't even any investigation of her.
Mother also charged with battery or some type of child assault in regard to girl.
So. Yeah, yes. But stop them from asking the mom at some point. Maybe she would have been a difficult witness, but it wasn't evidence in this case. There was also testimony that she was supposed to meet a friend, never met with that friend because of what happened. She never identified who that friend was.
Asked about all this on cross-examination, right? That was fair game for the defense counsel, and I think he did a very thorough cross-examination.
Sure, absolutely. The defendant did controvert the claims against him by pleading not guilty and by pointing out the holes in the investigation. The issue is, what did the prosecutor mean when he said that her account of the sexual assault was uncontroverted? What was he referring to? Who else could uncontrovert it?
Talking about the narration that laid out what happened, which ended up in sexual assault of her. She's got to tell her story, and the prosecutor has to get the story out to the jury, and then the jury has to decide, do they believe her or not? I mean, they could not believe her. Now, consent was never an issue in this case, right? It never happened. That was the defense, correct?
The defense was that the state didn't prove that it happened.
Right. So it never happened.
Right? Yes, yeah. Right. But there are many...
If it had been consent, you'd had a whole sort of different issues that would pop up, but that's not what we were dealing with here.
Right, right. So, but the... There are many ways to both challenge and bolster credibility besides arguing that it was undisputed or uncontroverted. Again, the consistency of her testimony, the plausibility of her testimony, her demeanor on the stand, they're all ways to show credibility. And again, I just go back to I think it's clear that the prosecutor couldn't have argued that he should be convicted because they heard no evidence, because Mr. Hoyle did not dispute her account of that sexual assault. And all he did was go from the active to the passive voice and say that it is uncontroverted, or her account of that sexual assault is uncontroverted and was not disputed. And again, someone has to do that, right? And the only person who could have, under the circumstances of this case, was Mr. Hoyle.
Well, there were other people that perhaps the prosecution could have presented, you know, like the school. There was a gentleman at school that she felt comfortable with, and he's the first one that she told what happened, and then he referred it to an investigator. Well, I don't know what, nothing was made of that really much at trial, except during her testimony, who she talked to, right?
But that's different than, that there's hypothetical witnesses who could have testified that she gave inconsistent testimony,
right,
is different than saying that her account is uncontroverted. It's, you know, that the fact he could it's perfectly fine for the prosecutor to argue that her statements were consistent, and he did do so. We know that when the prosecutor knows how to say her statements were consistent when he wants to argue that they were consistent. This was a different argument. Okay, he made that consistency argument, but he also made this argument that the defendant should be convicted because because Hannah's testimony was uncontroverted, when she was the only one,
were instructed by the judge to consider only the evidence that was presented to them. So I think that's part of how that argument got put together. You can't consider something that wasn't evidence. There are a lot of things that could have been evidence from the state or from Mr. Hoyle, right? He
right.
didn't have to testify. He could have put on other things, but he had no obligation to do so and decided it was better not to do so, which certainly was a way to proceed in this case.
Yes. But the and again, there's no question that if the prosecutor can argue, you know, if there's a defense theory, like a factual theory, like if there was presented, that she had a motive to lie for some reason, that presented some specific factual theory that was unsupported by the evidence, the prosecutor can point that out, you know, that was not supported by the evidence. And again, this is a very narrow set of cases, and why this is the first time I think this court is hearing it, where there is, it is just the defendant who can controvert what was happening.
You could say that about any rape that occurs in private. Any rape. So you'd have a per se rule that if it's a rape, you can't use the word uncontroverted prosecutor in your closing argument because only the defendant could say it didn't happen or it wasn't me or whatever might be raised. Correct?
I think... Well, I'm not requesting a per se rule, okay? I just want to be clear about that.
But what you're saying is that he was the only one, excuse me, he was the only one that could have controverted her testimony. And what I'm saying to you is, isn't that true for any rape that occurs in private, which most of them do?
Yes, the count of the actual assault, in most cases, yes, can only be between the two. In most cases, though, there is some corroborating evidence, and so the prosecutor...
But that's just not true, I got to tell you. I mean, it is not uncommon to have zero corroborating evidence because the truth is, we all know that most sexual assaults, there's a delayed report, whether it is as an adult or it is a child. So there actually is not a lot of corroborating evidence. I will tell you, both from having... not only prosecuted them myself, but having been the Violence Against Women Resource Prosecutor for the entire state of Wisconsin and helped prosecutors in every county prosecute these cases, there isn't. They're very complicated. This is where I just am still having an issue. I'm hearing you say, with your passive voice argument, is that what the DA in this case implied was that the only person who could controvert the victim's testimony was Hoyle. But part of the prosecutor's argument is that there was zero testimony that the victim would benefit from falsely accusing Hoyle of sexually assaulting her. So are you arguing today that Hoyle is the only one who could have talked about, who could have introduced some benefit that the victim would have had from falsely accusing him? Because I don't see that.
And that's why I didn't challenge those parts of the comments. We didn't. It was absolutely, the prosecutor can point out that there's no that evidence of a motive to lie can come from other witnesses besides Hoyle.
There's no question. Doesn't that completely take down your argument then? If your argument is that the only, what I keep hearing you say is that the only person who could controvert her testimony is Hoyle, and yet you're conceding that someone else could have talked about what the benefit to her could have possibly been. I don't know what it could have possibly been, but it's possible. Someone could have testified to something.
The prosecutor was specific about no evidence controverting the sexual assault. So evidence of a motivation to lie could come from, you know, she tells a friend that, you know, she's jealous or she's angry at this person for some reason, and that could come from someone other than Hoyle. So the fact that there's no evidence of a motive to lie could come from witnesses besides Hoyle. So there's no problem with saying you've heard no, it's undisputed that she had no evidence to lie or that she had no motive to lie. You can say that. Prosecutor argued, you've heard no evidence disputing her account of that sexual assault. Those are two different things. He was specific about the actual assault. He wasn't talking, where he was saying this, he wasn't talking about the evidence, any evidence about a motive to lie or anything else about her credibility. And, you know, regarding the federal cases cited in the brief, those courts have near unanimously said that they look in the context, they do a case by case basis, but where they say in this specific context, when the defendant is the only person who can controvert it and it hasn't otherwise invited it, or there isn't some other contextual factor that overrides it, it's just as a matter of logic, the jury would naturally and necessarily consider it to be a reference to the defendant who did not testify at trial. And now in my string cites, you know, all those cases I cited, I tried to, in the brief, I did try to find the cases that were the more recent and that had the most succinct summary of their version of the test. And in those cases, it might not be the situation where the defendant really was the only person who could testify. That's how they distinguished it. They said, you know, they would say, as a general rule, the prosecution can argue that the evidence is uncontroverted unless the defendant is the only person who can controvert it. And if you look at the cases, when you drill down to them, they refer to the specific cases in their circuit or other circuits where it was a situation like this where it was where the defendant was the only person who could dispute the testimony. If there are no further questions, yeah, that's all I have. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you.
We've heard some discussion and had some discussion about whether indirect comments can rise to the level of a Fifth Amendment violation. While the case law does support that indirect comments could rise to that level, if there's nothing else that we make clear today, it's that the violation, the comments must be clear. While they may not need to be direct, they need to be clear. So what I mean by that is just by going back to the language of the test. The question is whether the language used was manifestly intended or was of such character that the jury would naturally and necessarily take it to be a comment on the failure of the accused to testify. This case came down to the primary witness's credibility. What the prosecutor said at closing was that we have one version of the story in evidence. It's not controverted. This all comes down to this witness's credibility, and here's why you should find her credible. And then the prosecutor ticked through all of the reasons why this witness's testimony should be credible. Now, Mr. Hoyle is explaining that what the prosecutor was saying is that the jury should convict because the testimony was uncontroverted. But I want to unpack that, because what we would need to find for a Fifth Amendment violation is that the prosecutor was saying, Hoyle did not get up here and testify, so you should convict. That is not what happened in this case. So this test is one that is not easy to meet in the sense of finding a constitutional violation. That is an important distinction to make here. In terms of the federal case law, again, we all know that the case law is not binding, but if you look at all of those cases, what the court is really looking at are the specific comments that the government made in the context of the record. It was not, I did not find one of those cases turning on the mere fact that there was only the victim and the defendant as witnesses to the crime. And so to hold otherwise, to say that only Hoyle could contradict or controvert the evidence in this case, is essentially to say that because there were only two witnesses to the crime, the state is unable to say that. And I would just say that invokes Justice Stevens' concern in his concurrence of the Hastings decision, where you would be cutting into permissible comment on the part of a prosecutor. Fifth Amendment violations should be taken seriously, but this court should adopt a contextual rule that would enable courts to view comments in context, to take the balancing interests into consideration. The defendant's rights not to incriminate himself, but also the prosecutor's ability to fairly comment on the strength of its evidence. And if the court has no questions, I will conclude. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you for argument this morning. The court will adjourn now. We will meet at 11:30 in closed session.